Hey, John Horgan.
Hi, George Johnson.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm in a different location than usual. I
Oh.
am in my girlfriend Valerie's apartment in Tribeca in New York City.
Tribeca, wow. Well, that's very swank.
It is pretty swank, especially compared to where I live, to my modest little bachelor pad in Cold Spring, New York.
Tribeca. I have fond memories of when I lived in New York of walking around Tribeca at night, and it's kind of this mix of desolate solitude where it hadn't been completely gentrified, and then all these bustling restaurants filled with happy, bustling young people.
Well, now it's just investment banker land. You walk outside and it's all these super fit type A males and females pushing their babies and carriages that probably cost more than my Prius.
So, wow, that's a new thing, the carriages. That used to be what you associated with Park Slope in
Oh.
Brooklyn.
It's very family oriented around here. And it's great.
Oh,
Valerie is right
that's
across.
new since I was there.
Yeah. I mean there's a park right out the window here that I can see it's filled with little kids. There's a school right over here. Beyond that, there's a gigantic playing field where there are always all these little kids playing soccer and baseball and all kinds of sports.
No,
And
that's great.
it's actually really nice.
So yeah, it's nice to know they're carrying on future lineages of investment bankers.
When you put it that way, George, I don't
All these little future derivatives analysts, and maybe I don't know, maybe they'll become
well,
poets
I
and
don't know.
beatniks.
I envision a world, George, in which there are no derivatives traders. I
Oh
have a
God.
dream.
I have a dream. This is about the time that war will end, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, which I
Well,
hope is sooner than we think.
War will end before derivatives end. I'm pretty sure about that.
Well, speaking of which, I keep hearing good things about your book.
Oh, well, it's kind of plugging along. I got a long ride from a radio station here in New York, WNYC, that
Oh,
was
yeah.
promoting it. Like this one guy, Brian Lehrer, kept talking about it for months.
Wow.
It was fantastic, and
Wow, God, that's great.
I'm actually giving a talk at a peace conference near Albany, August 17th and 18th.
Wow.
So if anybody out there in Blogging Heads land wants to come, it should be pretty easy to find.
Oh, that's great.
So yeah, war hasn't ended yet, but
Well, you've got the idea out there.
And I see that you have a big article in National Geographic that you've told us bits and
Oh,
pieces about
God.
over the years.
Yes, this dates back to 2009. It's been in the works for that many years.
Well, congratulations on it finally coming out. I read it this morning and I thought it was, George, it was so much fun to read. And
Oh, good. This is very different from what I usually write.
well, it's real, like kind of, I don't know, macho adventure. I mean, it's like, yeah, gonzo science writing.
Yeah,
It's
I'm on the edge of your seat, tearing across the Texas Panhandle, chasing lightning storms with the giant Kahuna camera. Yeah, it was fun to do something really different like that.
you've got a knack for that kind of action journalism, George.
I had no idea, so maybe I can get a book out of something like that.
Well, give us the backstory.
Yeah, so basically, so this guy, T Tim Samaras, this guy, this engineer from the Denver area, he's also a tornado chaser, but in recent years he's been really concentrating on chasing lightning storms. And the idea is, they know from taking really high speed photography, I mean video, and then slowing it down, so they can take tens of thousands of frames a second with these cameras called the phantoms. And when you do this, you can see that when lightning, like, the sequence is that it starts out with what they call a step leader that, like, comes from, like the sky, and, like, it steps down, you know, zigzags down, you know, what looks very, very slowly and gradually, but, you know, this is all happening in a few milliseconds. And then, so it just kind of takes this, you know, semi-random, semi-structured zigzag trail down from the sky, and they call that the stepped leader, and that's usually negatively charged electricity. And when it gets within a certain distance of the Earth, it's, you know, the charge is enough that it pulls up a surge of positive electricity from the Earth. And then when the two connect, you know, that's the moment really when the lightning strike is born. So it sends down the feeler, and then the other feeler comes up. The two connect, and then this huge amount of current comes surging up from the Earth into the sky, and then it retraces the ionized trail that was traced out by the downward step leader. And that's what you're seeing when you see lightning.
You're not seeing the bolt before the circuit is completed.
Right, right. You're not seeing any of that stuff. So you're just seeing you don't see the step leader at all unless you do slow motion photography. I mean, you know, high speed and then slow it down, slow motion photography.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so then it, yeah. Yeah.
That's cool. I had no idea. So you are actually seeing, I mean, our impression is that the lightning comes from the sky and goes down to the Earth, but actually the circuit originally, or the lightning bolt actually starts from the Earth and goes up into the clouds?
Yeah, I mean the initiating event, it starts from the clouds, you know, the step leader going down, but then what you actually see comes up from the Earth.
Yeah.
And then after that, there are after flashes where it'll, you know, depending on all kinds of conditions, where it'll, you know, flash up and down, and you get this flickering, you know, flickering effect. But mostly, for the large part, what you see is lightning descending from the sky is an optical illusion, because it's this almost simultaneous flash that's originating from the ground and going up, but so fast that you would never sense it as either upward or downward. But, you know, it just really just flashes and oscillates, and then your brain kind of imposes, you know, what it expects, which is the lightning coming down from the sky. And also, since when the bolt's following up the path that was carved out by the step leader, you know, that has this sense of, like your brain sort of thinks of water, you know, going, like tributaries feeding into the main stream, and it looks like tributaries are, little tributaries of lightning feeding into the main bolt. So all this stuff kind of contributes to the sense that the lightning striking from the sky to the ground, but it's actually more complicated.
So this guy, this camera that he's using,
oh yeah,
it should be sensitive enough to capture the whole process.
Yeah, the whole thing. So right now, if you look at, you can find a lot of these on YouTube, and a lot of them actually are things that Samaras himself took with the slower 10,000 frames a second cameras.
Yeah,
and really
this
slow.
One is a million. Frames a second?
Theoretically capable of a million frames a second, hundreds of thousands. And
unbelievable.
And so the idea is that, so when you see these other videos, they're really cool. You see the step leader come down, and then suddenly there's just this blinding flash, and it blinds the camera because it's so powerful and it happens so fast, so you don't see any detail.
Mm-hmm.
And what he's hoping is, if you do it at hundreds of thousands to a million frames per second, you'll see the exact moment when the two connect, and maybe there's some kind of interesting pattern or structure that will tell you something about lightning that we don't know. And there's quite a lot they don't know. And the camera itself is just this wonderful kind of combination, super high-tech Rube Goldberg contraption. It was originally used after World War II at the Nevada Test Range and places like that to film above ground explosions. And the way it works, it's mechanical. So it has this huge turret. The whole thing weighs, like a ton, approximately a ton. And it has, so he has it in the back of his trailer, mounted permanently in that back there. And then there's this turbine inside, yay big around as I put up my hands. And then the turbine is spun around by a tank of either compressed helium or compressed air. If you need to go really, really fast, you use compressed helium. For slower speeds, I use air because it's cheaper, I guess. But anyway, so this compressed gas is causing this turbine to spin around thousands of RPM, and at the center of the turbine is a prismatic mirror, and it's taking the image coming in from the camera lens and then bouncing it onto a series of 80 separate little lenses that are each, in a sense, a separate little camera that are each coordinated, so they take sequential, so they're getting like a sequential image. So the original camera, that was a strip of 35mm film, and they would expose like 80 frames, and then, you'd just have, this tiny little sequence of time, because each one was approximately a microsecond apart. So you have 80 microseconds of film. Mm-hmm. And then, and that's when he first learned the camera and was using it in this company he works for. And then later he was able to buy it for scrap as military surplus.
Can I just ask you something? Was this camera by any chance built by Harold Edgerton?
Oh, I don't know. It's the company was I'd have to look back at my article, but it's in my article, the name of the company. But it was a commercial product.
Product.
With a very limited audience, mostly of probably just the U.S. government.
Well, just to fill in the viewers, Harold Edgerton is this legendary physicist at MIT who I think pretty much invented ultra-high speed photography for military purposes originally. He developed all the instrumentation for taking pictures, I think, of the atomic bomb explosions and then the hydrogen bomb explosions. He built a company that specialized in instruments, I think, not just visible images, but I think also X-rays, other parts of the spectrum. And he also is the person who, he developed these cameras and opened up this whole world of these bizarre things that happen that we can never see because our vision processing is too slow.
Yeah.
So one of the classic images is just the drop of milk hitting a surface,
and it splashes
up, and it forms this perfect crown with little beads that look like pearls around the rim of the crown.
Oh, I've seen that or similar. Yeah, and it's just like a whole different world when you get into this time scale.
Yeah, and a bullet going through an apple, he did a lot of images of bullets going through playing cards. I did this profile of him back in the mid-80s when I was working for this engineering magazine, IEEE Spectrum.
Oh, yeah.
And he actually sent me a bunch of his images, and I have this beautiful photograph that he sent me of a – it's the moments when a football player, a kicker, his foot is striking a football. Mm-hmm. And the football is still it's still in place, even though the toe is embedded deeply in it, and there's a little puff of dust coming off of the football. That's the only sign that the thing is going to go flying off and that this impact has been made. It's just it's black and white. The shoe of the kicker is really old fashioned looking.
That's great.
He's just this incredible character.
We had this idea, there's this whole new world when you get down to the microscopic level, and then you in space, and then, showing what, when you get down to the micro, whatever you would call it, temporal space, and seeing things.
Which is a huge industry now.
Yeah.
And, now I think they're down to, I don't know, femto and picoseconds and.
Yeah, and a lot of it depends on, like this camera, which does Well, yes, yeah, so it's doing microseconds, but it has really good, you know, really high resolution.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get cameras that fast commercially and probably faster, but, you know, they tend not to expose too many pixels. So.
And is this electronic? I mean, is it
digital
now?
He retrofitted the old film technology. Originally, he was trying to use it with the film, and then he retrofitted it with electronic sensors.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked it up. The name of it is it's called a Beckman and Whitley 192.
A Beckman. Okay, so that's Beckman. Not the.
Surprised this guy wasn't involved in the company, because this is a big company that, you know, did this. They made a lot of specialized equipment for recording things in, you know, extreme conditions like that. But it's really a trip to see this thing, and it's just such a behemoth that you have to aim the back of the trailer at the lightning storm. So you're pulling off on the side of all these farm roads in the middle of nowhere, and huge storms coming in and lightning striking everywhere, and it was pretty exciting. But the thing was, so this started in, I think it was 2009. It's possible it was 2008 when they first asked me to do the story, and because they had gotten on to this, and there was a photographer, Karsten Peters, this really good German, just amazing National Geographic photographer, and he really wanted to do this story because he had, gone with this guy tornado chases. So anyway, they asked me if I wanted to write it. You know, I said, sure, it sounds like a nice departure. But then, you know, like the first year, he wasn't able to go out for some, you know, reason. I think he was still perfecting the camera. And then the second year we went out, I went out with him for, a few days, two times during the summer, and he didn't get the shot. And then the agreement was with the magazine was that, well, you know, it's pretty unlikely that he'll get the shot, and it's even more unlikely that he would just happen to get it when you're there, but wouldn't that be great? And if not, it's still a good story, you know, just the story of the quest. So I wrote it up as the story of the quest in 2009. Yeah, and then they accepted the story and paid for it and said, you know, this is fine. And then they came back and said, well, we just had a meeting and we thought that, I mean, this is such a great story. We want to give them another chance. So I said, yeah, it's fine with me, you know, just, you know, we'll pay you extra for your, you know, extra time in the, you know, in reporting and then revising the story. So 2010 comes around and we're, you know, exchanging emails. You know, Samaras has this list of people that, you know, he keeps surprised of his activities. And he discovered some software glitch with the camera. So he's going all summer working with a software engineer and trying to get this fixed. And then finally, you know, it was Labor Day weekend. And I thought, well, it's got to happen pretty soon because that's about the time the lightning season in the Southwest comes to a close, and he just never got out. So 2009 was a bust. I mean, that was 2010 by then. 2010 was a bust. And then in 2011, that's when he got out again, and I rejoined him. And this time we went up to this lightning. It's essentially a lightning observatory on top of this 11,000-foot mountain in southern New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And they shoot rockets up into charged clouds and induce lightning bolts. So he was figuring, well, at least he could go up there. And, you know, the problem was getting lightning to stay in place long enough that he could aim the kahuna, which he calls it, the giant camera. And it takes a few seconds to fire up, you know, to spin up, like a minute. And then once you spin it up to speed, you can only keep it spinning for just a little while so it doesn't melt. So there's all these constraints, and I thought, well, this way will eliminate a constraint because I can aim right at where they're shooting the rockets. And it's amazing when they shoot these rockets from this mountaintop, and they have wires attached to them, and then the lightning is like summoned from the sky and vaporizes the wire. But you know, then the problem was, I won't describe it because that's kind of the end of the story. So.
Well, I just have to ask you that I was surprised about the rocket technology. They can reliably induce lightning strikes by basically sending a big wire up into a cloud?
Yeah, and it's they have to wait till so they monitor. It's really an amazing place. It's called the Langmuir Atmospheric Observatory, and it's on top of the South Santa Fe Baldy down by in the Magdalena Mountains in southern New Mexico, and it's run by New Mexico Tech, which is the school in Socorro, New Mexico. And you drive up this winding, long dirt road, you know, to get to the top of this mountain at 11,000 feet, and on the peak, you know, like back in the 60s, they excavated these underground bunkers, you know, that look like, you know, sort of what you'd expect an underground missile silo to look like, and there's all this equipment down there, and then the Rocketeer is down inside here, and before they set up like a bunch of rockets in a circle, and they wire them up on top of the mountain, and then the guy or woman goes down into the bunker and is monitoring the weather conditions. You know, like they have these meters that measure the charge of the atmosphere in kilovolts per centimeter. And when it gets to a certain point, you know, they anticipate that it's close enough now that we can probably induce a lightning bolt, because they don't want to wait too long, or because if the lightning bolt happens naturally, you know, then it'll basically short circuit the sky, and they have to wait for it to charge up. And the idea with the rockets then is they want to shoot these things up and then have the lightning be attracted to the ground connection that the rocket's making through this long wire. And that way the lightning will come down in a predictable location. They can surround it with meters that measure like, you know, X-ray intensity and things. So
I guess the question is, are the physics of the induced lightning significantly different than
that's a big question that they talk about. I mean, they know it's got to be different because you know it's just more controlled, and you know in this case you have the downward step leader is going to be hitting a rocket,
right,
you know, the wire leading it to ground, and of course the wire coming up from the ground is carrying positive charge, so it approximates the process, but they figure, you know, it's the closest they've been able to figure out a way to do something like controlled experiments but Samaras's attitude was like, well, you know, this is great and it would be a good proof of principle for the camera to see if I can get the shot, but he really wants to get, you know, wild lightning in the field and get
wild
that moment
lightning
of contact. Wild lightning.
I love
that.
Let me ask you, you sort of already alluded to this, is I love it when we're forced to realize that some sort of really ancient, familiar, natural phenomenon turns out to be really fucking hard to explain exactly.
Yeah.
And is lightning in, you know, we've all heard about the experiments that Franklin did back in the 18th century.
Yeah.
And so it seems kind of like this old fashioned stuff that scientists probably would have understood a long time ago. That's not the case. It's still fundamentally very strange.
Yeah, and it's really amazing. Really rather amazing things that aren't understood. Like, for example, you know, you have to have a certain amount of charge, obviously, build up in the sky, so you have a certain amount of electrical potential before the step leader is going to start, you know, seeking, you know, the positive charge downward to cancel it out. So you can calculate how much voltage or difference in charge you're going to need, and there doesn't seem to be enough. Or a better way to put it is between the top of the lightning activity tends to start when there's a charge difference between the top and the bottom of the cloud, for example, positive and negative. And this potential, you can calculate how powerful that potential would be, and how powerful the potential would be to go from the cloud toward the ground, and you can figure what the natural resistance of the air is, and when you do this, it turns out that the amount of voltage being generated in the clouds isn't nearly enough voltage to theoretically, you know, jump the gap and break down the resistance of the air and cause lightning. So there's something else, there's some other factor that's missing, and You know, one theory is that cosmic rays originally trigger the lightning bolts with this extra little, you know, little boost of charged particles from space. But, you know, it's all controversial. But, yeah, things like that are another mystery is, you know, like lightning. You would think it would always hit, like, the tallest thing around, especially if you have a collection of tall metal things around. But it actually doesn't. You know, it'll just sort of, you think it's going to hit this huge tower, and then instead it'll hit a little tree, you know, 100 feet away or something. So, of course, a lot of that's just the randomness of the process. But the people who study this stuff are just great. Like, there's this whole team at the Langmuir Laboratory, and then throughout most of the summer, they just, every day, they drive up to the mountain and do these lightning experiments. And they also send up weather balloons to study lightning, and they have... It's really great.
Have any of them ever been struck by lightning?
I don't think any of them have. I mean, they're really careful. And then Samaras, the guy who chases the lightning, has all these meters in his truck that read out the charge of the atmosphere. And there's even this recorded woman's voice, this electronic computer voice that calls out. So if you're outside, you know, so usually you'll be outside of the trailer, and you know, he's setting up the stuff inside, and everyone's looking around to see where they should aim it, and the regular, you know, regular as in the photographers taking the pictures for the magazines, running around taking pictures, and then you'll suddenly hear the lightning lady automatically, you know, chiming off how close the lightning strikes are, and you can see what the charge is on the meter, and when it gets to a certain level, you know, everyone is advised to get inside the trailer so you don't get
cool.
struck.
I have a funny relationship with lightning. I grew up in a house when I was a kid, a big barn on a converted barn on a ridge, and it was covered with lightning rods, and we were struck all the time. And when lightning struck the house, it felt like it had been hit by a bomb. There was a huge bang, and the whole house would shudder. And that was when I was pretty young. And then I got older, and there was this house I stayed in Nantucket with my family. I must have been about 13 or 14, and I was in a bedroom at the end of the house, and I was up there one summer, and then I just left. I don't know, visiting a friend or something. And while I was gone, lightning struck the room I was in and actually charred the mattress that I slept on.
Really?
And one more lightning story. I was in Virginia Beach. A friend of mine in high school, his parents had a place down there, and he invited, I don't know, maybe four or five of his high school buddies down there. And there was this shack out in back of the main house. And we're all back there, I think, you know, drinking beer, smoking pot, whatever high school boys do. And there was a single light that came down from the ceiling, just a wire with a bare bulb on it. And there was this huge electrical storm outside, and we were all really getting into it. And suddenly, the light bulb exploded, and there was this gigantic flash in the room, and my body was hurled as though this giant hand had slapped me against the wall of the shack.
Oh my God.
It was I guess the electricity had come down the this wire, and what was weird about it was that it was like a detonation. I mean, I don't understand the physics of that at all, but it was really like a small bomb had gone off in the room. I didn't feel a shock. I just felt
just the impact of...
Yeah.
God, sounds like Stephen King.
It was really cool. And then the funny thing was that we all started screaming and yelling, and we ran out of the shack, and we ran into the main house where my friend's parents were having this really demure dinner party. And so all these shaggy-haired, bloodshot-eyed boys running in, babbling about lightning. And
oh, wow. God, that's great.
Yeah. So
amazing
lightning.
Stuff. Well, you know, I kept asking people, you know, people talk about ball lightning.
Yeah.
And And everyone I would ask, like I asked Samaras this, and they're and this other guy, Bill Wynn, who's like the senior Lightning researcher at Langmuir, and you know, and they all basically was like, well, you know, we don't know. There's definitely what seemed like credible reports, and the question is still out on whether ball lightning exists. And lots of people have ball lightning stories of, and a typical one is one that my grandmother had where she was sitting in the parlor of their house, farmhouse in Missouri one evening, and then a ball lightning came in one window and went out the other window. I've heard versions of that, but.
Yeah, that's kind of the classic story. I didn't know that these reports are not necessarily considered definitive.
Well, there's reports, from what I understand, that are considered reliable. I didn't really look into ball lightning, but it's still considered controversial. You know, whether it really, you know, I mean, there's not enough observations, and it's never been observed under any kind of, you know. I don't want to, I mean, certainly not controlled conditions, but, you know, there's just not enough credible observations, I guess, that they accepted as being definitely real. And also, there's just, you know, really, it would be a real mystery about how this stuff forms. This one book I got on lightning science had a little section on ball lightning, and it speculated on different theories. And my favorite one was that the ball lightning was a little miniature black hole.
That works for me.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just great stuff, and boy, it's just so visceral compared to a lot of science these days.
You know, I just looked back. I'm not sure, maybe we even talked about this before. I looked up the story about Ben Franklin's kite experiment, and you probably know that the origins of this are kind of murky, that he didn't write about it himself, really. The first person to write about it was Joseph Priestley, who wrote up what he said Franklin had told him about the experiment. I think it was almost 20 years after it supposedly took place.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's not clear. You know, some of the details are a little bit hard to believe. So, for example, if Franklin had actually been holding the cord, he could have been electrocuted unless his shoes had been very well insulated.
Yeah, it just depends on how good a path, I guess, to ground he was providing.
But I think what Priestley said, and this sounds pretty credible, is that Franklin's first sign that that something was going on was that he could see threads on the, I'm not sure if it was a string or he could actually see all the way up to the kite that were electrified. And so they were standing apart the way that the hairs on a cat, if it's got static electricity in the fur, stand apart from each other.
Yeah.
And that also so there was the key, which apparently was electrified, and Franklin determined that it was electrified by moving his hand near it, and there'd be a little bit of you could see a circuit forming between the key and his skin, but he didn't actually grasp.
So Franklin, you know, being a pretty smart guy, probably then let go of the kite or thought this was enough to. You know, it's interesting about Franklin. I always, you know, just mostly through ignorance, just figured that he was just kind of this, you know, gentleman scientist, dilettante when it came to things like electricity. But he was really considered, you know, very, very, very respectable lightning researcher in those days. And
yeah, I guess he's credited with having come up with the idea or come up with the terms negative and positive for the opposite charges.
There's some interesting twist on his view of that. I can't remember what it was, but he wrote and communicated with Priestley and all of these other people. And there's actually a book just specifically about Franklin's electricity experiments.
I was just reading about some of his lightning rod experiments. He apparently had an initial version of it that alerted him to when a strike had occurred that involved a little brass bell that would ring, and apparently it drove his wife crazy because when there was a storm, the bell would constantly be ringing, and it made her nervous because she also thought that maybe lightning was going to incinerate all of them. And
those early days of electrical research were so amazing. And then, there was, this real overlap of people, like the early electrical researchers thinking that it was connected to the paranormal.
Ah.
Which reminds me of something that you wrote recently in Scientific American.
Yeah, well, that's kind of an interesting, good segue, George. so at the end of June, I took my two teenage children to London to visit my brother. And he, it turns out, lives just down the street from the Science Museum. Really a wonderful museum. One of the best parts of it.
The one in Kensington there on Exhibition Road?
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful.
They've got this wonderful exhibit on the Industrial Revolution, and particularly all these different steam engines, which are, I actually teach history of technology, and I have a section on steam engines, and I've seen the diagrams and everything, but it's just so cool seeing these things right up close. They're beautiful. They're works, big clunky industrial works of art.
Yeah.
But while I was there, there was an exhibit on Alan Turing. I think it's his 100th birthday this year.
Yeah, centennial.
Yeah, and it had all this stuff. Yeah, it had all this great stuff on. I mean, I didn't realize that he was kind of a hands-on guy too. He helped to build to design and even partially build a computer in the 1940s at a British university where he had an appointment. Mm-hmm.
Like before he was at Bletchley Park with the Enigma machines and.
Right, I guess so. Just to let people know who Turing is, he's one of the people.
Yeah, I just looked really quickly, and just to remind me, it's a centennial.
Yeah,
May 10 to 12.
And Alan Turing is often described as, I don't know, the godfather or father of, certainly a pioneer of computation.
Oh, yeah, the whole basic concept of really, defining computation and with his imaginary Turing machines, it's like probably the most fundamental insight in computer science and the universality of computation.
And he also did. He was one of the first people to start thinking about whether computers can think and how you could possibly determine whether a computer can think. And he came up with this idea called the Turing test, mm-hmm. where you basically have a human and a computer hidden, and you feed them questions by typing in the questions, and based on the answers, you try to determine which is the computer and which is the flesh and blood machine.
Yeah,
and it's still very controversial, but really nobody has come up with a better method of determining artificial intelligence.
Because some people would argue that you're just like skimming off the behavior, but then other people would argue, if you can do that and it's completely plausible and you can't tell the difference, then what does it matter?
Not?
So I kind of go both ways on that. But yeah, Turing was amazing. And
the great tragedy of his life is that he was a closeted homosexual, and He was outed toward the end of his career, and this is after he had been a hero for the British war effort, because he had helped to decode this German encryption system called Enigma, and it was really a gigantic advance in the Allied effort against the Germans, helped them figure out what the Germans were going to do in advance. Yeah. In some cases, and as a result of being convicted of homosexuality, Turing was forced to undergo what was considered to be a kind of cure
for homosexuality. Hormone treatments, right?
Yeah, hormone treatments, and which were humiliating for him and also had various physical effects that were really unpleasant. And he ended up almost certainly, he died of arsenic poisoning, and I think it's generally accepted that he took his own life. So,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, one story that he poisoned an apple.
Yeah.
You know, just like sleeping, I mean, snow, just like, you know, like the Snow White kind of thing, except, you know, deadly. Yeah. You know, yeah, there's a couple of good, really good book. You know, there's Alan Hodge's biography, you know, Turing the Enigma, that was inspired a Broadway play, and then there's this really shorter, very nice treatment of his life by David Levitt, the novelist.
Oh, yeah. I took a writing class with David Levitt once.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Back in the early 80s when he was just up and coming, this young gay writer.
God, yeah. Well, he's really, yeah. God, so before he was famous.
Yeah. But anyway, probably the most startling thing that I learned in the Turing exhibit, you know, because I knew the general contours of his life. Mm-hmm. What was that he had an interest in ESP and paranormal phenomena.
Yes, that's really struck me about your column. I didn't know this.
Yeah, I'd never heard of that either. What's really cool is in this famous paper he wrote in which he introduced the Turing test, he has this little discussion of the implications of ESP for the Turing test. He says it's possible,
right,
if you have a human with ESP, that it could confound the test in various ways. And so, you know, he sort of discusses that, and
as the objection. So as I recall, he's going through objections. Possible,
yeah,
objections to the Turing test, and then there was the argument from ESP.
Right.
Yeah, so, I remembered that now, yeah.
So apparently he was really impressed with experiments done by this guy named Rhine, R-H-I-N-E.
Oh, J.B. Rhine?
Yeah.
Is that his name? Is he like the car, little triangles and the different shapes? And, yeah.
And his work impressed a lot of people. So this is when you have one person. I think that the standard way it's done, and I remember doing this when I was a kid. You have one person who's looking at an array of cards. He had, I think, 5 cards, different colors and different shapes. And another person is trying to read that person's mind to see what card they're looking at.
Yeah.
And Rhine claimed that people definitely could guess what somebody else was looking at a rate better than chance. And he said that particularly there were some people who had a real gift, who were especially good at guessing cards correctly. Again, much better than chance. And so Turing took these results very seriously. And it just reading this about Turing, it reminded me of some other famous people who scientists.
Yeah.
Who have taken ESP very seriously. Not necessarily that they believed in it, but they thought that the evidence was very suggestive and that it was worth investigating further. So I just wrote a post for Scientific American about some of these folks, and it includes William James, who's one of my intellectual heroes, who was very impressed with a medium in the late 19th century named Leonora Piper, who claimed that she could channel ghosts and could divulge facts that she couldn't possibly have known in any other way. At least this is what James concluded. Sigmund Freud, this kind of surprised me, because he's such a notorious hard ass and skeptic, especially about anything spiritual or religious. But apparently he didn't really like talking about it in public, thought that he had experienced telepathy with, among others, his daughter, Anna Freud.
Oh, yeah.
They carried out some long-range experiments. And Freud thought that they were successful.
Yeah.
Another person, I mean, everybody knows about Jung, but and
Jung,
his belief in
synchronicity
and all that stuff. But Jung also had a fascinating correspondence with Wolfgang Pauli,
yeah,
the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, who, again, had a reputation for being very, very tough and destroying.
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah. What do they call him? The Wrath of God? That's how he signed his letters?
Right.
The Scourge of God?
But he apparently went through a period when he had a nervous breakdown and was very distressed and had strange dreams, and he went to Jung for therapy,
yeah.
And Jung interpreted Pauli's dreams and convinced Pauli that there might really be something to synchronicity. And just two other people I'll mention in the present. Freeman Dyson, I think we might have discussed the fact that he believes in ESP, this great physicist. On the other hand, Dyson is such a contrarian that I suspect him of saying he believes in ESP just to irritate people. and one more interesting case, Brian Josephson, who won a Nobel Prize, I think younger at an earlier age than any other so-called hard scientist for discovering something called the Josephson effect, this very peculiar quantum phenomenon.
Yeah.
And he had a kind of nervous breakdown, at least this is what he told me, in his late 20s, and after that he had these visions, and it convinced him that that ESP and other paranormal phenomena are real.
Oh, but then later he was convinced it was just the result of a nervous breakdown, or
no, he still believes in it. He still writes all these letters.
So it was a nervous breakdown that led to this great breakthrough.
Yes.
Yes, he blew out the doors of perception.
Right.
Yeah.
And
well, you know, there was the electrical guys, Crookes, you know, the guy that did all the early experiments with cathode ray tubes and things, and he thought where you take like an evacuated tube and put a big voltage across it, and you get this glowing plasma, you know, luminous plasma of depending on the strength of the vacuum, it can be anywhere from purple to green, and he was speculating that this was ectoplasm, you know, mm-hmm. the stuff that ghosts are made of. And then J.J. Thompson, who, you know, discovered the charge mass ratio of the electron. I read a really interesting essay report that he wrote where he went to a seance, but he was debunking mm-hmm. it. And then, you know, was one of the early people like the magician, the Amazing Randy, who would basically show how there were all these plausible, perfectly natural, mechanistic ways in which someone could have pulled this off, and then unless you could prove that it hadn't happened that way, that it was quite a leap to, you know, say you were communicating with the spiritual world.
Yeah, and Randy has a standing offer for somebody who can demonstrate a psi phenomenon to his satisfaction, and you know, of course, the true believers say this is a bogus offer. But but it's basically why I'm not a believer. I figure if it's real, it's something that can be demonstrated and replicated, and it just hasn't been.
Yeah, I mean, if it's that subtle.
Yeah. And now, of course,
that's where I'm at with that too. But boy, you know, you meet so many people that you would never expect who are just convinced based on some personal experience that, you know, this is true. And, you know, there are two attitudes, I guess. One is that science will eventually uncover this, and it can only happen under very, 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 very specialized conditions, which, you know, always has to make you kind of suspicious. But, you know, then again, you know, there's a lot of things in, like, science where, you know, when you really get to the realms of high energy physics where something can happen only under these very rare conditions.
Yeah, it reminds me of what I think Richard Feynman said about string theory, that string theorists don't make predictions, they make excuses. And I think you could say the same thing about parapsychology.
It's like the efficacy of prayer studies, you know, like that big one that the Templeton Foundation did, and then it seemed to show that like a triple blind experiment in cardiac patients who were prayed for by other people anonymously, so that, you know, the patients didn't know who was being prayed for, and the doctors didn't know which patients were being prayed for, and the prayers didn't know which patients they were praying for. So triple blind experiment, and then it came out showing that the cardiac patients that were being prayed for had a slightly greater chance of dying than the others. I mean, it was one of these things where it was just such a small little tiny difference, and basically what the study said was that there was no difference. But
so if I'm sick, the first thing I tell my relatives is, whatever you do, don't pray for me.
It can only hurt. Yeah, I would still be of the mind that it can't hurt. But
I do think I have been at scientific conferences and had these private conversations with people, and I do think that many more scientists believe, or at least are open-minded about even ghosts and shit like that. Than sort of mainstream science, kind of like the AAAS version of science, would have the public believe.
That's interesting. But their take on that would be, you know, they're not ruling it out, and if the evidence does emerge, this implies that there's some kind of physical reason for explaining this, even if you're having to posit some new force or some weird quantum thing that it would go from being supernatural to natural.
Entanglement,
you know, what we know about the natural realm.
Entanglement is like fairy dust that you can sprinkle over this humdrum world and make it all magical and filled with all sorts of fantastical things.
Yeah, like you can explain consciousness with quantum mechanics because they're both so mysterious.
Yes,
yeah,
right. Okay. Just in the way that you were saying was done with electricity, say 100 years ago, when electricity was still really strange and
marvelous. Yeah, it was ghost stuff. And then they slowly it came up with this. Well, in fact, there are these invisible little particles called electrons, and they're not really particles. They're actually waves, and they're not really waves. They're waves of probability, and they're all identical, so you can think of it as there only being one electron in the universe in different states.
Right.
So nice, solid explanation.
Electrons, maybe they're, you know, the ghosts of people from another universe, from a parallel world.
Yeah.
And listen, as long as we're talking pseudoscience, in our remaining time, do you want to fill us in on the great fluoridation controversy of Santa Fe?
Oh, yeah, thanks. This is so strange. Did you know that this was still considered by some people to be a burning issue, whether you should fluoridate public water supplies to prevent tooth enamel breakdown and tooth decay?
I don't think I did, unless you might have mentioned it to me a while ago, but I didn't realize
it
was so serious.
No, I just discovered it. I picked up our local newspaper one day and read that the city council had voted to stop fluoridating water. And then I read some of the testimony from the people who showed up at the meeting, and it just sounded like something you'd hear from the John Birch Society in the 60s, you know, where fluoridation was a communist conspiracy to pollute our precious bodily fluids. And then I looked into it more, and there's actually a big group called the Fluoride Action Network. And if they get wind of our little blogging heads conversation, we'll be bombarded, both of us, with email from them, repeating what they think are legitimate scientific claims from their website. We'll get emails, I'm sure, from listeners who say that we're putting too much faith in the technocracy and the experts, and there's all this case against fluoride. But what it comes down to, basically, is recently the Health and Human Service Department has been, you know, revisited its standard of fluoridation. And the standard now is they recommend that community water systems, you know, they recommend, they don't, you know, make them do this, as a lot of the opponents seem to believe, but they recommend that the fluoride level should be somewhere between 0.7 and 1.2 milligrams per liter, which is one part per billion is a better way to say it. So one part per billion, and some communities have way, way more fluoride than that. And it was these communities back in the 1940s that people, you know, started comparing notes, and they got the sense that people in these high fluoride communities were getting less, significantly fewer cavities. Like some of the old reports say 40% fewer, but, you know, these weren't very well controlled, you know. This wasn't modern epidemiology, which has enough problems. But anyway, this became, you know, really this consensus, and there have been many studies over the years that have, you know, supported this. And so they recommended that the standard be 0.7 to 1.2. So recently, you know, after doing this big study in getting together with the EPA and they decided, well, you know, people are getting a lot of fluoride now that they didn't used to get from toothpaste, mm-hmm. and things like this, and fluoride mouthwashes, and maybe we don't, maybe we can lower it just to, instead of saying 0.7 to 1.2, just say 0.7, because the downside of fluoridation is at some point, if fluoride gets too high, you can get this cosmetic condition called fluoridosis, where it's like a staining of the teeth, you know, and some
I've
people consider it a problem and some people don't, but, you know, if you've seen someone who grew up in an area with high fluoride, there's nothing at all unattractive about it, I don't think, but I'm sure it comes in different levels. And so that's the downside. And so the other, thing that's opened up this can of worms is that a study by the National Academy of Sciences, they were asked by the EPA to evaluate the EPA's fluoride standard, which was for entirely different reasons. This was how high a level of natural fluoride in the water, should be set as the standard. And the EPA had said 4 parts per billion. And that above that, there was a slight risk of fluoridosis. And of course, more as it increased. And then the NAS has recommended that they lower that to 2. So basically, there's the recommended standard for dental stuff is 0.7, and 2.0 is they say, well, don't go that high because a few people might get fluoridosis. So just based on all that, it's opened up this campaign and this idea that scientists are some people say scientists are recognizing that fluoride's actually bad for you, but then they start looking at studies that, you know, as with anything, you can find studies correlating with, you know, really high levels of fluoride with all kinds of bad things.
Yeah.
You know, cancers and mental retardation and so they leave out, you know, a lot of the details, and the message is basically, you know, well, look, God, you know, the EPA's lowering the fluoride standard and the HHS, and then it turns out there's this other study here from, you know, villages in China showing that villages with really high, you know, like in some cases tens to hundreds to over 1,000 parts per billion of fluoride in their water are having problems with fluoridosis. And then they'll make the next leap and say, oh, and there are these studies that, you know, say that, you know, there's some chance correlating this with, you know, with a bladder cancer, you know, just like, you know, you can find a study that will, you know, correlate. It really reminds me of the whole cell phone microwave brain tumor thing, where you can find these outlier studies. And they've put this all together into this really slick website and this very coordinated effort. So what I learned as you write anything about this, as I did on my blog, the Santa Fe Review, and you're immediately bombarded with kind of this mix of mostly really sarcastic emails, like, you know, you stupid journalists upholding the scientific establishment. And they're really persuaded that they have found some smoking gun study, or they have understood the evidence in a way that's eluded the entire public health community. And it's either eluded them or is being suppressed because it's a conspiracy.
George, I mean, do you want to divulge your connections, your enormous payoffs from the fluoride industry at this point, you know, just in the interest of transparency?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the conspiracy theories is that since fluoride is an industrial waste and there are restrictions against disposing of fluoride waste by industry, that this is a conspiracy for the chemical industry to get rid of their fluoride. So they don't even have to pay to get rid of this stuff. They can make dentists buy it.
One part per billion?
One part per billion. You can really expose of a lot of fluoride at that level. You know, and again, we're talking about, you know, the hazardous waste of, you know, just vastly, you know, orders of magnitude more than this. And then people take this study. So it was interesting looking into this. You know, there's many things I didn't know. Like in China, there are these villages where, you know, it's just a big problem nationwide that people from certain areas have, you know, really severe fluoridosis. Mm-hmm. You know, this cosmetic condition in their teeth. And then all these studies have been done comparing different levels of water. And they did, you know, do these studies and correlating it with IQ. And they found that these villages that had really high fluoride levels, that there was possibly a correlation where it would appear, if the statistics were right, to shave a few points off the average IQ.
Even though I would imagine if the levels of fluoride in the water are high, they're probably, God knows what other natural toxins in the water
exactly.
as well.
Yeah. And the socioeconomic things and differences. Yeah. And then there was this one big meta-analysis that pooled a bunch of these studies and basically, you know, came out saying, well, you know, we do show that there's a statistically significant connection between high fluoride levels, you know, not the levels that are recommended for dental stuff, and the slight effect on the IQs. But then the study goes on when you really read it to say that this could be, we realize this could be within the range of experimental error and, you know, all these caveats, which of course gets washed over too. So then you add that into the mix, and I found a quote from some, well, like in Florida, the county that includes St. Petersburg, Tampa, this huge population area recently was persuaded, the city council was persuaded to stop fluoridating the water. And I found a news story, and this one man said it was a conspiracy by the government to put fluoride in the water to make us stupid so we're easier to govern.
I don't know, that actually sounds like a pretty good idea.
Yeah, that one rings true, huh? Yeah.
That could explain
but anyway,
the tea
I'm
party.
Just flabbergasted to find that, you know, this issue has not been laid to rest. And
listen, I bet. Here's a thought. I bet if you look at the people that are part of this anti-fluoride campaign, that they would have unusually high levels of fluoride in their system, which would might explain their views of science.
It might cause this anti-science view.
Yeah.
I mean, so much of this is just, you know, people start looking into science and they expect there's going to be like one smoking gun study where the way I described it in my blog is where you take identical twins and take them from their parents at birth and raise one with a certain level of fluoride in the water and another without fluoride. And of course there's not. You know, there's like one epidemiological study after another. They're all imperfect and, you know, have their weaknesses and their strengths. And over the years, this accumulated evidence has convinced, you know, the American Association of Public Health, the American Dental Association, that this is a good idea to, you know, to recommend that there be this threshold amount of fluoride. And,
right.
And they're saying now that, well, you know, people are probably getting more fluoride than before, so let's back off a little just to be conservative to several times lower than the standard that's believed to risk fluoridosis. And
yeah, it leaves me a little ambivalent because, you know, I love trying to find flaws in mainstream scientific positions.
Yeah,
but,
I like that too.
But this sounds kind of like Tea Party-ish somehow.
It is Tea Party-ish.